Hello and welcome to Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. I am your host, Lauren Corman, here with Carl Orzechowski. He's not going to be bringing us any news today because we have two different interviews that we're going to be doing. And first up, we're going to be speaking with Paula Stibbe from Austria, and we're going to get an update about the imprisoned activist and the situation, two in particular with people who are on hunger strike there. It's a really bad situation. We're also going to hear from David Rothenberg at about the quarter after point. And for people who are familiar with Animal Voices, longtime listeners, you'll know that the introduction and the music that we hear at the beginning with the clarinet and some of the bird song is the handiwork of David Rothenberg. And we interviewed him a while ago about why birds sing, about interspecies communication, his jam sessions with birds. And we're going to have him back on to talk about his new book, Thousand Mile Song, Whale Music in a Sea of Sound. It's a really wonderful read. I really had a good time going through it. So before we jump into the interview with David Rothenberg, we're going to connect with Paula in Austria. Hi, Paula, are you there?
Hi, yeah.
Thanks so much for being part of Animal Voices today. I know that we're reaching you under pretty stressful circumstances right now. Can you tell us a little bit of background about what has happened to that collection of Austrian activists?
Yeah, I can. It seems like such a long way away, and it's really good to know that there's people so far away who are interested and care about what's happening to us here. On the 21st of May in Austria and Middle Europe, police carried out a huge operation against animal welfare, animal rights campaigners, and respectively their NGO organizations. This consisted of raiding their homes at daybreak, busting into their apartments, busting into the offices where they work, and completely clearing everything out. There's a huge number of human rights violations that happened during those raids. For example, people were held at gunpoint naked, people were threatened, people weren't allowed to contact a legal representative, and many other distressing things. As a result of that, 10 people have been placed on remand under anti-terrorist law. And they remain on remand until today, unfortunately, which is about 7 weeks later now.
I should mention, too, that you're an animal rights campaigner with the Association Against Animal Factories, and my understanding is that all of the activists that were arrested are associated with that group. Is that correct?
Yeah, I guess you'd have to ask them. we have quite a colourful movement here in Austria. We have a couple of national organisations and a lot of people like myself who, yeah, we consider ourselves animal rights campaigners, and that's the priority, and we don't necessarily feel affiliated to one group more than the other. And I think that's an important part of the animal rights movement. However, saying that, you end up doing perhaps more campaigns and getting more involved with some groups more than others, and things change over time. So, yeah, there's a strong bond to the VGT, yeah, definitely. And it's one of the NGOs that was hardest hit, of course, in this operation.
When we interviewed Martin Balak a few years ago, we were really struck by how successful the campaigns had been in Austria and the incredible changes that had been made. I guess, is your sense that perhaps the success is part of the reason which elicited this police response and this government response? Do you have a sense of what would have prompted such extreme action?
Yeah, no, it's not so much a sense as it's blatantly obvious that this is punishment for doing such effective political lobbying work and making such good reforms. I mean, I think Austria's reputation around the world for having really good animal welfare reforms is something to be proud of. It's something that one would expect that the authorities would be proud of. Unfortunately, they see it differently. They've decided to punish the movement. One can assume that these reforms have made it more expensive for farmers to produce animal products. They need more space for the animals, they need better feed, better conditions all round. And I guess these people that paying more money these days to abuse and use animals, they might well be voting for the party that is probably behind this operation. Mm. Yeah.
What were some of the changes? Can you speak specifically about some of the reforms that have happened in Austria over the past few years?
Yeah, we've had the ban on fur farms, ban on wild animals in circuses. The biggest achievement, I think, is the ban on battery cages for chickens, egg-laying hens, and more recently a ban on cages for rabbits produced or kept for meat. It was around the time that the battery cage ban came through that we started to really notice that our activities as an NGO were being hindered, to put it politely. We had a case, for example, where the Home Secretary said in Parliament that the VGT used violent methods, and we tried to sue him for slander for that. Mm. He, unfortunately, due to his position, is immune to that kind of claim, but he did have to kind of retract that, take that back, and when we subsequently called him a liar in the press, he didn't even respond anymore. We're also, aware that there's been several attempts to hinder legal demonstrations taking place. In Austria, every citizen has the right to demonstrate. All they have to do is register a demonstration with the police. And we've had some very obscure reasons come up in over the years for prohibiting those demonstrations. And also, more recently, we're aware that there's political move to try and retract the laws, these reforms that we've managed. There's plans afoot to try and retract them. And of course, with key people in prison now, key lobbyists, we fear that the retraction of those laws will be easier.
Hmm. Would you say, given the, it sounds like the climate in Austria was changing towards animal activists now for a while, were you surprised by the extent of the action taken against these activists?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, one has to also say that, as with any movement for social change, there are activities on the fringe that perhaps do move over into the illegal side of the law. But relatively speaking, those activities in Austria are quite low. And we're sure that that's due to Austria being one of the countries where we can shift some things. You know, there isn't that build-up of frustration that we've seen perhaps other countries where legal means over years and years and years of hard work just don't shift anything or improve anything for animals. So we are very surprised because we see the situation as being different to in many other countries that do have an animal rights.
I think if this hasn't already happened, there's going to be this desire to paint all of those activists, and probably animal activists in general in Austria, as hardened criminals and terrorists and that kind of thing. Can you talk a little bit about the way that the press has talked about activists, or even the way that perhaps the police have, just to give us a sense of how the story is being covered in Austria?
The story is being covered in Austria. I think it's starting to turn a little bit now because it's becoming a little bit embarrassing for the authorities because they've got no evidence. If any journalists actually take the time to scratch the surface of this story, they very quickly realize that these people are being held under this ominous anti-terrorist law, which is paragraph 278A of the Austrian Criminal Code, which is actually a law which was introduced to try and tackle drug rings, human trafficking, mafia rings, really severe crimes. And what it essentially means is that you can be held responsible for crimes that other people have done if it can be proved that you belong to a group, criminal organization. And this is the strategy that they're trying to take. So journalists are realizing that there's no evidence that any of these 10 people who are sitting on remand are connected in any way to any crime. And so the tide is starting to turn a little bit now, and people are starting to ask, well, what is this law they're being held on? And isn't it being inappropriately used? And we're starting to, well, the Green Party here, we've had their support right from the beginning. The Socialist Party, who are actually in government, the coalition government at the moment, are also voicing their support and that's becoming strong.
Can you walk us through what has happened since the arrest? That there were these raids, people were held at gunpoint, I believe you said, and what happened after that point? And if you could walk us through that and then bring us up to today.
Well, all in all, 23 offices and homes were raided. Many people were brought in for immediate questioning and then released. And as I've already mentioned, 10 people were held on remand. Following that, those 10 people were held on remand. Well, within 48 hours, they had to be brought before a judge who served them then with remand sentences. When that 2 weeks was up, there was no evidence against them. We were sure that they would be released, and they weren't. and then for the remand sentence, for 4 weeks, and that 4 weeks was up yesterday, and we were again so sure that they would be released yesterday because it's just such a miscarriage of justice, and it's so blatantly obvious. But it didn't happen yesterday. I think we're still in a state of shock here now, and the remand sentence has now doubled. It now would be 2 months, which takes us into September, which is when the next review hearing would be. The only hope we have at the moment is that we have made an appeal to a higher court, asking them to recognise that the remand is unlawful, and we're expecting their verdict this week sometime. Mm. And should they rule that it is indeed unlawful, then they'll have to release the people.
There was very disturbing accounts of Dr. Balak going on a hunger strike. Can you tell us a bit more about the hunger strike and what has happened over the course of that action?
Yeah. As far as we know, Martin, he was arrested on the Wednesday morning, and the last time he ate was on the Tuesday evening, the night before. In the first 48 hours, he didn't receive any vegan food anyway, and he very quickly made the decision as soon as the first two-week remand sentence was given that he would go on hunger strike. He was on hunger strike for around 40 days before he was artificially fed. Over that 40 days, he drank fruit juice and sugared tea, and he was on in the hospital wing of the prison where he's being held. Running up to this review hearing yesterday, he decided to eat again, otherwise he wouldn't be able to attend because the review hearing was in another town. And he very worryingly has said that should the verdict from the higher court rule against him, then he wants to continue the hunger strike, and this time without the fruit juice and without the sugared tea, which would mean just water. So we're very, very concerned about that. And there is also talk that all 10 may decide to do this as a protest. And one can understand that this is the only means they have open to them to protest against this injustice.
Do you have a sense of how people are holding up? You mentioned that there are birthdays coming up, and I'm just wondering if you've had a chance to be in any kind of correspondence or with any of the activists and know how they're doing.
Yeah, we do have. We've set up an easy way that people can write letters. We have a vegan society here in Austria where people can write letters to. The address would be info@vegan.at. And you can write your letters there per email, and we'll print them out and send them on to the people. The other option would be to go to www.vgt.at, and there you can find under the English flag the English version of the website, and there's all the information there that you can write to people and keep up to date with the latest developments and so on. Mm. Felix has a birthday coming up on the 15th of July. Jürgen has his birthday coming up on the 19th of July. So those are two birthdays coming up next week.
Have you had a chance to talk with anybody directly?
Yeah, I've been visiting Martin regularly. We had an awful visit during his hunger strike where he collapsed. We wrote immediately a report to the Amnesty International, who have also written a critical statement about this whole case. During this visit, I was actually taking an interview, taking notes of an interview for the English Guardian newspaper, who wanted his comments on the situation. And he got so upset about the situation and was so weak that he collapsed. And I immediately called for the guards to call a doctor. And these guards just stood around. It was an unbelievable situation. And it took about 5 minutes for them to eventually come in with a stretcher and cart him off. It was an absolutely horrific situation. I've never witnessed quite such human stupidity and callousness. In that kind of situation before. It was unbelievable. That was one of the worst moments in this whole business. I think some of the prisoners are having an easier time than others. I understand that some of them are getting better vegan food. I should perhaps add that they've been separated into three different prisons, so that it's impossible for us to keep a constant vigil outside one prison. It's just not feasible. Some of these prisons are outside of Vienna. They're out in the sticks, so it's not possible to keep ongoing protests, daily protests there, although we're doing our best. So I think the standard of care that these people are getting is different in the different prisons, but we're keeping a catalogue of some of the different violations that the people are going through. Some of them have had medical care refused. Some of them haven't been able to go outside in the courtyard, which is actually a right that they do have for an hour each day. We also know that some of them have been locked up in broom cupboards for no apparent reason. We're doing our best to keep on top of that and making reports to Amnesty International.
We don't have a lot of time left, but I wanted to just turn it over to you if you have any final comments, and then we'd really like to have you back on the show maybe next week or the week after to talk more fully to what's going on. But if you have any, if you do have any last thoughts that you'd like to share with our listeners, please do so.
I think this situation is a very worrying situation for anyone involved in NGO work anywhere, not necessarily just involved with trying to make things better on human health. In Austria, this isn't about illegal activities. It's got nothing to do with it. This is purely because the movement here is starting to really make waves. We are politically effective. We are starting to have a voice, and that's being punished. That's what this is about. This is about state repression. It's not about illegal activities.
Again, for people who maybe would like to be involved or to contribute some way to the struggle, is there an address again that you could give us where people could write or things that people could do?
Yeah, I'd really urge people to go to the www.vgt.at site and click onto the English flag. There's a couple of us native English speakers doing our very best to keep everything up to date. You can see on their online petition where you can write to the different politicians online. It gives you updates of the solidarity demos that are taking place outside the different embassies around the world. It keeps you up to date on the legal side of things. It's really a good place to get as much information as we have. We don't have any more information ourselves at the moment than is actually on this website. So it's actually all you would need to be able to support our prisoners as much as you possibly can. It would be on that website for you. That's www.vgt.at.
Great, and we'll link to that on our website as well.
Lovely.
Paula, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for contacting us. It's good to have been on the show, and thank you very much for your support.
Well, we'll continue to follow the story and hopefully be in touch with you in the future. We really appreciate you being here.
Likewise.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye for now.
Bye-bye.
We were just listening to Paula Stibbe, and she's from the Association Against Animal Factories. She is calling it VGT. We're translating it into the Association Against Animal Factories. And we obviously urge people to get in contact with the organization and do what you can to add your voice against this really egregious injustice that's been happening against these activists. It's just awful. We're going to take a short little break, and then we'll come back with David Rothenberg. We're going to talk about his new book, Thousand Mile Song, Whale Music in a Sea of Sound. Please stay tuned. Hi, welcome back to the program. You're listening to Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5 FM. Before the break, we were speaking with Paula Stibbe from the group in Austria where so many activists are currently being unjustly incarcerated there. And now we're turning to a slightly delayed interview with David Rothenberg, and it's my great pleasure to welcome back to the show. We've interviewed him before, and it was really a lot of fun. And today we're going to be speaking about Thousand Mile Song, Whale Music in a Sea of Sound. So David, welcome to the show.
Thanks for inviting me back.
It was really fun to have you on before, and I immensely enjoyed this new book as well. So maybe before we jump into anything, I was going to read a quote that I got from your website that I just thought was really beautiful, and maybe a good way to enter into this conversation about interspecies whale music. And you say, "If the voice of an animal is not heard as message but as art, interesting things start to happen. Nature is no longer inscrutable, some alien puzzle, but instead immediately something beautiful, a source of exuberant song, a tune with some space for us to join in, at once a creative place for humanity to join in."
That's right. You know, once you, if you no longer imagine the sounds of animals or some language you don't understand, but if you hear it as music, realize that we often appreciate music when we really don't know what's going on in that music. We just hear it as being beautiful, and we just, as you can kind of love and groove to music from some different part of the world that's sung in a language you don't understand, if you start to imagine animals are making music, then it makes a lot more sense to us. Mm-hmm. Right away, biology kind of starting to agree more with that idea that the sounds of many animals is much more like music than like language.
And there's been various different searches, which you talk about, where people have tried to get animals. I remember the section you talk about dolphins and people thinking, well, the way to communicate with these animals is to teach them to speak our language, and aha, that's the way that we will have some, you know, interspecies dialogue.
That's right. You know, it really doesn't make that much sense. You know, first of all, might it be more fun to learn their language if they indeed have language, and if what they're doing is more like music, then we can start to play along and see what happens and make some music together that neither species could make apart. And you know, one thing I talk about in this book is how amazed people were to discover that humpback whales in particular, alone among whale species, was really singing something much more like a song than like a language. They really were repeating whole series of phrases and rhythms that really had a shape and form, a beginning, middle, and end. But, you know, if you started to imagine, like, information was there, you'd say, like, oh, it's not that much information because they're repeating these same patterns over and over again. But each sound is so beautiful. It's really much more like music, where we repeat the same melodies and rhythms over and over again, and we love it, and we don't say it's boring.
Mm. You make the argument in the book that we really haven't been listening to whale song for very long, or not in any kind of concerted kind of way. And the 1970s, of course, were a time where that started to change a bit, and then it sort of waned from there again. People sort of started to lose interest again. Can you take us back to the 1970s and the explosion of interest? I really thought that it was a very interesting and important argument that the environmental movement really was inspired by the animals themselves and the quote-unquote discovery of the whale song.
That's right. People didn't really know much about this song until its recordings were released and became very popular in 1970. And although it's possible to hear humpback whale song sticking your ears underwater if you go deep enough, no one seemed to really talk about this. And when the recordings were out, people realized that, oh, this incredibly beautiful music is coming from whales. And at that time, whales were not very much on the people's radar. They didn't think that much that they were worth paying attention to, or that they were in danger. People didn't know much about them. When the song became known, the whole idea of saving the whales grew, this whole movement grew out of this. Many pop songs were written by all kinds of musicians based on either the story of the whales or the sound of whales, and I think it's one of those kind of basic grounding concerns of the environmental movement, caring about whales through first hearing this song, something that largely has been forgotten about over the years.
Why do you think it touched people so much?
Because it's so beautiful and so remarkable and such a surprise. You know, who thought that in the sea there were animals singing with such depth and power and beauty? You know, a song that actually, in the case of humpback whales, the range of what they sound like is actually kind of the range of the human voice, the very low sound up to very high, back and forth, but all within the range of what we can hear. It's a kind of slower thing. It can take... complete song is like 20 to 30 minutes. It's a little too slow for people to really follow the whole pattern without, getting sort of impatient. But it's very, very beautiful. And the idea that an animal could sing this repeating pattern over and over again, up to 24 hours in length, is really awe-inspiring and made these great undersea giant mammals so much more appealing to people. Wonder about them, what are they actually talking about? Are they saying something long and complicated? Are they very smart? Are they kind of closer to humans than we previously thought because they're making music? And over the years, the more we learn about them, the more amazing things get discovered about their behavior and their sounds, how they live. You know, compared to birds, my previous book, Why Birds Sing, was about bird song, which, of course, humans have been wondering about as long as we've existed as a species. Millions of years we've listened to bird songs, wondered what they mean, appreciated them, thought about them. Whale songs, we've just had like 40 years to muse about and think about. And so it's no surprise much less is known about these animals.
Yeah, I think indeed people think of oceans, and you point this out in the book, as being this silent world.
That's right, you often hear the great silence. And actually... sound travels much faster and better in water than in air, strangely enough. Because it's not what you would think, but it's kind of the physics of sound. It likes to go through dense stuff, travels faster, further. So much so that the sound of the very largest whales, fin whales and blue whales, sounds that are too low for humans to hear, these sounds, in the best conditions, can travel 5,000 miles in about an hour, all the way across an ocean. We don't know if the whales are really listening from that far away, but they could. Sound really travels that far, which is just another awe-inspiring fact of this mysterious undersea world.
I think the converse of all of this for me, reading it, and you allude to this throughout the book, but while there's the beauty on the one side of it, there's also this kind of heartbreaking realization too, when you think about the subjectivity of these whales and the ability for them to perceive sound in different ways, that there's so much other stuff that we've put in oceans that create all sorts of noise pollution and huge sounds that these creatures are dealing with as well.
That's right. I mean, that's probably the biggest sound threat to whales' ability to communicate so very far is the general noise of ships in the sea. Just the fact there's always thrumming, deep shipping sounds everywhere in the ocean, just about everywhere. That's got to affect their long-range communication. We also have, the much publicized tests of different kind of sonar technology that the United States Navy is always doing. And they keep wanting to do these tests, even though there's very little disagreement in the court system in the United States. Every court says they should stop doing the test. There's no debate. And now it's going to the Supreme Court, I believe, in the coming months. The Navy still says we need to test our sonar for national security, even though it's unclear who the enemies are these days. They still want to keep testing sonar. And they fully well admit that it does harm whales, not universally, but certain species of whales are definitely damaged by these tests. They know that, but they just think that somehow it's worth it. But every court disagrees with them, so we'll see what the Supreme Court says. Nevertheless, there's still, what whales have to deal with under the sea. The general shipping noise may cause them more trouble. Polluted oceans may affect their, health and changing climate in the future. At the same time, there's many more whales than there were when we hunted them until 1986. There's a little bit of a conservation success story then. because the International Whaling Commission basically banned commercial whaling around the world. Most countries around the world wanted to stop killing whales by the 1980s, in part because of the discovery of this song and the realization we had killed so many whales much more recently than the time when people actually used whale products. By the time we really figured out how to exterminate whales, nobody really needed, you know, general people didn't use whale products so much. We just got so efficient at killing. Only a few countries now still say we should kill whales, and the rest of the world really disagrees with them.
Mm-mm.
And I think even most people in Japan, if you ask them, do you think you as a country should still kill whales? And most of them will probably say, no, we don't need to do this.
Mm.
You know, I talk in the beginning of the book what happened when Scott McVeigh went to Japan, and one of the two guys who discovered how beautiful the humpback whale song was played people in the whaling industry these recordings, and these whaling executives would just burst into tears and say, you know, we didn't know how beautiful these sounds were.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about some of the things that surprised you. I was really moved by your descriptions of whale traditions, whale culture, the ability to learn new things, the way that different songs can hold a group together. Can you tell us more about some of those particular things about whales that people might not know?
Yes, I mean, you know, various species of whales really have what could be called culture, in that, you know, groups of them learn from their elders, from their parents, other older whales, you know, the younger whales learn how to behave in certain ways. And a different group that's totally the same species, even in the same place, might learn different ways of living. Like in the Pacific Northwest in Canada, you have the most studied whale sounds of any species, orcas, off of Vancouver Island. Every single whale is identified by name and number, and you know who's in which clan, who's in which family. And you can tell by their patterns, they're black and white, it's easier to identify individual whales. But also because of their sounds, different families make different sounds. They also have different ways of living. Most of the resident whales, they're called, the ones that are better known with name and number, they mostly eat fish. They hunt together in certain groups. They live in certain, they sort of stay in the area. There's other groups called the transients that eat mammals. They eat seals. They eat other whales, big whales. They gang up, go after them. And maybe the occasional deer or moose, whatever mm-hmm. they can catch. And they have a whole different repertoire of sounds, a different way of hunting altogether. And then there's offshore whales that don't come into shore as much, and we're not sure what they eat, but they have a whole different repertoire of sounds, different ways of swimming together. And these different groups of whales are the same species. They're genetically the same, but they just live in different ways. The traditions pass down from generation to generation. So when the Canadian scientist Hal Whitehead, he said, this is culture. Whales have culture. He wrote this, proposed this idea, and published in some scientific journal with about 50 responses from different scientists. They were agreeing or disagreeing whether they thought culture was a good word to use for whales. Some people were outraged. They said, no, animals don't have culture. And others said, no, this is real proof that they do. Mm-hmm. They really learn different behaviors. And a lot of what we've learned about different kinds of whale cultures comes from the sounds. Different groups of them make different kinds of sounds. And here I'm talking about orcas, and also sperm whales, and perhaps also beluga whales, although they make so many complex sounds, we actually know much less about them. But they're all suspected to have this kind of cultural differences in sound. But humpbacks with the big songs, they have a whole different kind of more homogeneous, amazing way of using sound, in that in any given ocean, all the male humpback whales are singing the same song, even if they're in Mexico, say, or in Hawaii. But then they also change the song across the whole ocean. They gradually change it. Maybe not so gradually, even from month to month it changes. But they all want to sing the same song. They all want to sound the same, but they don't keep it the same. They change together. We don't know why the whole population of singing whales, who all likes to sound the same, wants to keep changing what they're singing. People haven't been able to explain this. And there's no other animal that does anything quite like this. It's like they're cycling through a series of hit songs. Everyone's got to have the latest up-to-date song. Mm. Or maybe it's something else that we just can't explain yet.
You mentioned that there's a tendency that people have wanted to say, well, this is all about mating. And of course, that's as far as we know, that's not the case at all.
Well, yeah, I love that story, that only the male humpback whales are singing. And so generally, assumed, a reasonable assumption based on what a lot of birds do, that this is to attract the attention of females. And that's what evolution often tells us is what goes on. But we've never seen a female humpback whale show any interest in this song. Only other males seem to be interested, and not in the rather traditional competitive way, but in perhaps a more cooperative way. And again, as I wrote about with birds, you know, the complexity of bird song, really elaborate, beautiful bird songs like hermit thrushes and mockingbirds and nightingales. The beauty and complexity of these songs is not easy to explain by saying this is just what the females like, because it's not clear that they like it. And in whales especially, there's no evidence that they like it. So it's very possible that evolution produces music on its own over thousands of years, over months and years and years. It produces the ability of animals to make music. And to me, that's a very inspiring, beautiful thought. Mm. Music is out there in nature. Some scientists will say, yes, evolution does that, but it's like a byproduct of important stuff. It's not important, it just happened. But other people will say, yeah, you know, this idea that beauty is produced in nature. Nature evolves beauty might be much more important than we realize. We just have a hard time explaining it. And so we tend to not ask questions we don't know how to answer. And this is one thing I wanted to do as a musician, is try and ask questions I really didn't know how to answer. Like, could I make music together with a whale? Mm. What would count as music? How would I know if the whale's paying attention? I don't even know how to answer that question, but I decided it was worth asking. So I went out on a boat with my clarinet, tried to play along with these whales.
I want to play a bit of whatever track of your choosing and come back and talk a bit more about how what you discovered and how you conducted your research. So
I should say track two is the best live, unedited, out in the field, clarinet and whale music.
That's my favorite
one.
Okay. So we'll play a bit from that, and then we'll come back with David Rothenberg. We're speaking about his new book. I really enjoyed this book a lot, Thousand Mile Song, Whale Music in a Sea of Sound. Highly recommend it. We'll come back with David Rothenberg. Just listening to a track from the CD that accompanies Thousand Mile Song, Whale Music in a Sea of Sound by David Rothenberg, and I believe you can also buy the CD separately as well, and that was a track called Never Satisfied. So David, welcome back to the program. Can you tell us what the heck was going on there?
Well, this recording was made underwater, so if you think it sounds a little odd, made from an underwater microphone called a hydrophone. and I was playing my clarinet. I was above water playing into an underwater speaker, broadcasting clarinet underwater, and I'm listening to the clarinet down there along with a large male humpback whale about 45 feet long, and he's like just under the boat, like 30 feet down, suspended there, singing, as they like to do. Motionless, he'll sing for like half hour, 40 minutes. And I wanted to see wanted to hear what this whale thought about this strange sound appearing in its midst. Did he sing along? Did he ignore it? And of the many times I tried this out in Hawaii 2 years ago, this was the one example where I really felt the whale was kind of interested in what I was doing and interacting and maybe altering what he was doing. And that just was an amazing moment to think that perhaps this whale was listening to me and responding. I don't know for sure. You know, it's like playing music with someone you can't speak to, some other culture in the world. And you're not sure what's going on, but it sounded interesting to me, so I put it on the CD. The name of the track is Never Satisfied, because that's the name of the boat belonging to the whale song scientist Jim Darling, who lives in Tofino in British Columbia when he's not in Hawaii studying whales, and he's just never satisfied what he finds out. He's just not sure. Not sure of his conclusions, as I think one should be if you're working with these strange, mysterious, and different animals. You can't be satisfied with what's happening. You can enjoy it, you can try and figure it out, but you can't be sure. And so that's how it came to be.
I appreciated the conversations that you allowed to come through in the book, and I believe it's in the chapter Never Satisfied where, maybe it's Jim if I'm remembering correctly, kind of razzes you about why are you doing this.
The one scientist who's most angry with me is named Mark Johnson.
Oh, Mark Johnson, okay.
And he just thinks, you know, this is just your own interspecies communication fantasy, you know. You know, you shouldn't be messing with these animals unless you've got a well-worked-out hypothesis, and this is just your own self-gratification. he was really angry with me because he thought, he says, you know, you musicians, you artists come, you mess with these whales, and we're trying to study them so carefully. You know, what gives you the right to imagine you can make music with a whale? And, you know, he's asking good, tough questions. And I wanted to put the whole report in there just to show you that it's not always such an easy balance between science and art, and they really have different approaches. And, you know, I really appreciate what these scientists are doing and how hard it is and how careful they must be. Someone must be in science to be sure of any conclusions. And in one sense, you could never be sure because you're just collecting a little bit of data and there's so much else going on. And musically, you know, it's a lot easier in the sense that if you feel that something happens in an encounter, it sounds intriguing to you, you know, you've got something there. You don't have to know exactly what's going on. If it sounds beautiful, if you present it in a certain way, that can be enough. You know, when you start asking what is actually going on here, you know, then it's hard to be sure. And some people have read the book and said, you know, this guy's never sure of what he's doing. He doesn't make grand enough claims about being spiritually connected to the whales. And I feel I'm just trying to be honest and try some things out and explore. And I don't know exactly what's going on, but I do feel some very unusual and beautiful music happened as a result, and that the whole story of people trying to learn from whales, interacting with them, is a really kind of glorious adventure that's just beginning. One other thing I report, you know, right after the Mark Johnson section is a talk given by Doug Chadwick, you know, who is a writes a lot for National Geographic on whales. He gives this speech and he starts saying, you know, whale science has accomplished a lot, but it's often very timid. You know, people really should engage more with these animals, try and interact more with them. And after I reported that story, I noticed just maybe last month it was published in, I think, National Geographic Adventure magazine published his report, which is also kind of a radical story by someone who, you know, is really part of the establishment of whale science and the usual cautious path. So I think, you know, I'm not the only one thinking that it's okay to interact with these animals, take some risks, because the more we learn about them, the more it seems they might not be as far away from us as we think. You know, I report that some pathologists were examining the brains of whales, you know, whales that had washed up on the beach and found that in humpback whales, their brains have a certain kind of neuron, a certain kind of brain cell called the spindle neuron, which previously was only found in the kind of animals that we know can experience complex emotions, like higher primates. We haven't found this kind of neuron in any other animal besides primates and now whales, suggesting that they can have the ability to experience emotion that's kind of like us. It's a rather, you know, slightly gruesome way of finding that out. It's like cutting open the brain of the whale and finding the neuron, whereas some people might just feel a connection to the whale, they can experience emotion. But, you know, science has its ways of working, and, you know, it's not going to be the same as people who can just sort of look an animal in the eye and feel a connection.
I really appreciate out of your work the sense of humility and the willingness to say, I don't know. And indeed, I think that the I don't know becomes in its own way a kind of ethical position or approach. And I'm wondering if you see your work as political or interventionist or moral in some way, that this is about raising awareness about how whales are being treated, perhaps a message against captivity. Is there sort of a moral undertone to what you see you doing?
I think you described the moral undertone pretty well right there. It is about all those things, you know. You want people to become more aware of what's out there, you know, what kind of beauty there is in the expression of animals that we often don't pay attention to. And that I'm, you know, saying, look, you should pay attention to this. We should listen more. You know, here's some music you might just think sounds really strange. It's recorded underwater. Everything's a little off-sounding. But listen to it. There's some beautiful stuff going on out there. It's going to take some time to attune your perception. Things might sound different. And that's a real aspect that is important to me when I might try and make music together with animals and also out of their sounds. Some of the music is made in a more conventional way, taking whale sounds and playing with them in the studio. A lot less risky in a way, but also has different results. Another part of the book, though, is presenting different people's stories, different ways of expressing things and explaining things. And there, not everyone agrees. You know, people tell their story, and it's not doesn't agree with everyone else. For example, one man I met who really knew a lot about whales was the guy in charge of the whales at the Shedd Aquarium in Chicago. You know, a lot of people think it's a crime to keep cetaceans in captivity, but how could you keep these beautiful animals inside pools that are just swimming back and forth, totally bored? And, you know, that's how I basically feel. But this guy, Ken Ramirez, you know, he knew more about beluga whales than anyone I met because he spent so much time with them. And he had a lot of careful answers to people's concerns. And he didn't brush away the views of people who said that there should be no belugas in captivity. He said, you know, you definitely have a good point, but here's... He had, you know, very careful, honest things to say about why he thought that sometimes this was okay. The biggest reason is that people can learn about these animals firsthand in a way without necessarily going to wild, distant places. For those who said, look, you know, how can you keep such an animal as this in a small amount of space? And he said, you know, these animals have all come from captivity, and, you know, we try and treat them as best as possible. We spent a lot of time engaging with them. You know, one of the things he often did with them is play music to them and really spend time with them in a way that people haven't in the wild. All the studies have gotten people interested in dolphins about how smart they are. At least the first several decades of studies of them were done in captivity. Now people are studying dolphins more in the wild. But, you know, there certainly are different views on this. I'm not sure myself how I feel about keeping these belugas in captivity, but I would say that my experience with them there was very positive one, and talking to this guy and how much he cared about these whales and interacted with them. I didn't feel like there was anything cruel in this situation. But I certainly would understand those who said, what? You know, you went to an aquarium where there were whales in captivity. I also tell the story of Paul Spong, who worked for many years with orcas in captivity in the Vancouver Aquarium, and then after 10 years or so he felt he had to leave. He couldn't justify spending time with these animals in such a confining environment. Now, of course, orcas are about 3 or 4 times bigger than belugas, and that is also part of the story. But, you know, there's a range of views on this issue that people will have, you know, and it was interesting hearing people say different things about it.
Your approach in terms of creating interspecies music, I thought, again, the book is just so lively, and I really enjoyed the conversation, the conversations that came through about your style and wanting to match or try to enter into the world of the whales in some way, music that maybe they would like, and you had other people telling you, you know, they like reggae, you should play reggae, and you said, well, no, I'm going to do something else here. Can you talk a bit about that in the last few minutes?
Well, yeah, Jim Nolman, you know, is the great master of playing music with whales. He's no one's done it longer than him, and so he's a little angry. He thought that you're just portraying me as an old hippie, and I said, no, Jim, it's not true. You're the hero here. You're one of the heroes of this book. But I just wanted to say that, you know, that's your view, playing blues and reggae to the whales. And you know, I don't want to deny that there's a difference. And he may be right. He may be right that whales prefer a groove. And I felt that in my case, I wanted to make music together with whales that was different than I would make without them, and really kind of push the boundaries of what counts as human music, overlapping with the world of whale music. And then we make some kind of music together that neither species could make apart. Mm. And, you know, it's not going to be, you know, for humans to listen to it or whales, they're going to be surprised. They're going to say, huh, what's this? It's a little different than I expect. So I think it does take a little time to get into the interspecies connection. And one thing I've thought recently as I've been playing concerts based on this is that it takes a long time for these whales to sing their repeating patterns of songs, particularly the humpbacks. And I feel like, okay, when I perform these, I should make the pieces longer. I should play like 30 minutes of a whale song, make people listen to it, find myself gradually lured into it, and, you know, really push people some more. So I'm starting to do a little more of that and really, you know, get more into the different scale of time, what these animals are doing.
We have only a minute left, so I'll just turn it over to you if you want to plug a website or offer any last thoughts on.
Well, I'd say you can go to thousandmilesong.com and hear a lot more of the music, and you know, see some pictures of the various journeys and read little excerpts. It's true, as you said, the book comes with the CD, and it should be around at all kinds of bookstores and online type places, and also the CD is available separately. It has the name Whale Music. It's also can be found around out there. And, you know, I would sort of, you know, urge people to, you know, whatever animals you get to experience in your day-to-day life, that you think about what they're doing and take their behavior seriously, take their ability to express their emotions and to play around seriously, and listen to what birds are doing, listen to what's happening under the water, under the sea, in the sky, and sort of take the possibility seriously that there could be art and poetry and music happening right around there.
David, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for inviting me on the show.
I
can tell you, you really have read this book, so thank you for really delving into it. Not every interviewer actually does that.
Well, it was a page-turner, though, I must say. I really didn't expect that, and I can
say
that.
I tried to write something that was really fun to read.
It was. It really was. So I'll let people know again. It's called Thousand Mile Song, Whale Music in a Sea of Sound. David Rothenberg, I didn't give you much of an introduction, but I'll just mention quickly that David Rothenberg is the Associate Professor of Philosophy at the New Jersey Institute of Technology. And he's obviously a composer, a clarinetist, and you can find out more about his adventures with whales in the book Thousand Mile Song. Thanks, David, for being on the show.
Thanks so much.
Great pleasure. I can't wait to see what you do next.
All right.
Okay, take care.
Okay, bye.
You've been listening to Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5 FN, and we're kind of even ending on time. So I will turn it over to Sergio and Dos Mundos coming up.